Members, we're going to get started. I would have preferred to have started 20-something minutes ago, but such is life. As I commented coming into the room, this Representative Erickson, this used to be the coldest hearing room in the entire Capitol, and it feels like they moved the furnace right underneath us. And of course, I'm wearing nothing but wool today, so we're going to move very quickly.
Okay.
Members, we have three bills today. Representative Moran, Slocum, and Davney, and I'll plan to take them in that order. I do want to pause very quickly. Where's our page? Oh, there he is. So, members, we have a new page, and I had promised to have him introduce himself to us. We have a lot of strong traditions in this committee, and one is that We nurture and produce dynamite pages. We also track dynamite pages, but they come out of here even stronger. We do have last year's page, Emily Edstrom, with us, and so she'll be helping as well. So many of you are familiar with Emily, but many of you have not met Simon yet. So Simon, I'm just wondering if quickly you can just tell us who you are, where you came from, where you studied, and anything else you think of might be of interest.
Wenzel, I was born in Tonka Bay, which is right next to Chelsea Orono area. I was from Minnetonka High School, graduated in 2010, then attended Boston University, where I studied international relations and political science, graduated a little over a year ago now, and now I'm here.
Welcome. Look forward to working with you. And then, members, we have a birthday in the House, and I'm not going to reveal his age, not because he might be older, but because some of you might think that once we go past 10 o'clock at night, he should be home in bed. But Jamal Lundy's birthday was yesterday. And to celebrate his birthday and to make sure that everyone had a nutritional breakfast, I have brought in some kolaches from Jarabik's Bakery. So what we'll do, Simon, maybe you can just kind of help pass those around. And Emily, maybe the other one kind of the other side. We'll kind of do it waiter style. Jarabik's Bakery until a few years ago was the oldest continuously owned family bakery in Minnesota. Well over 100 years, same family. They have sold it to someone else, but they have the same old bohemian recipes from the old country, so you're going to love these kolaches. So with that, Representative Benson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to congratulate you on your good choice for this young man. He is from Minnetonka High School. I have not personally met him, but that school is one in my district. And knowing the people who attend, I'm sure you made a very, very wise decision.
And you and knowing the people who taught at that high school, probably even wiser decision. So, very well. Thank you. Representative Moran, let's get down to business. Would you care to move your bill, House File 2133?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Mr. Chair and members. I would like to move House File 2133.
Representative Moran moves House File 2133. What's that? Well, she's not a member? Representative Moran, I'm so used to having you on this committee, but you're not on policy.
Oh, I'm not.
Wow.
I
holy
miss
cow.
It.
All right, we've got to get you back. The chair moves House File 2133 be referred to the Committee on Higher Education, Policy, and Finance. Representative Moran, I don't believe you have any amendments, so why don't you proceed to describe the bill, what it does, and then introduce your witness today.
Thank you. And again, good morning, and I just want to thank you for to the committee for consideration of this bill today. You know, as we know that currently, you know, college has really become really unaffordable for so many, and when we do attend college, when our young people do attend college, they find themselves coming out in huge debt. Many have come out with that debt, and right now in our current environment with lack of jobs. So kind of like, and I think more importantly, the dream of going to college just seems impossible for so many of our young people today. And so as a solution to address the financial barriers to post-secondary education, several states and communities have implemented state or private funding up to 100% for all high school students. In Georgia, there's the Georgia Hope. In Kalamazoo, Michigan, there's the Kalamazoo Promise. Similar programs exist in Tennessee and Kansas, etc. As a result, there's data which demonstrates that when there's a tangible pathway to post-secondary education, students' academic performance and behavior improves dramatically. Even in Minnesota, we have the Power of You, which provides post-secondary funding for 2 years to residents of Minneapolis and St. Paul to attend MCTC and St. Paul College if they graduate from qualifying schools. Today, we would like to expand that statewide to all students. So before me, I have Mr. Michie, who would like to also testify on behalf of this bill.
Wonderful. Good morning, Mr. Benjamin Michie, I believe, from the Council of Black Minnesotans.
I am from the Council, and the last name is pronounced Mackay.
Mackay. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Why don't you give us your full name just for the record.
Okay. My name is Benjamin Mackay. I'm an educational consultant and a board member for the State Council on Black Minnesotans. Chairman and other esteemed representatives of the House Committee on Education Policy, I am grateful for this opportunity to speak with you today concerning the Council's legislative proposal to study solutions that would increase access to higher education and eradicate the achievement gap. I will keep my comments brief, and I will be happy to respond to any questions when I am finished. As you know, the Minnesota Legislature empowered the Council on Black Minnesotans to ensure that people of African heritage fully and effectively participate in and equitably benefit from the political, social, and economic resource policies and procedures of the state. Today, approximately 320,000 Minnesotans indicate that their race is black alone or black and combined with another race. There are 76,400 black immigrants living in Minnesota, representing 23 African nations. When the first significant number of blacks arrived in the Free State of Minnesota prior to 1858, they essentially had nothing. Today, black Minnesotans contribute the following assets to this great state: strong cultural diversity, $3 billion in consumer spending power. We operate over 12,000 businesses with almost $1 billion in sales, employing 10,000 people and generating annual payrolls of $258 million. Minnesotans of African descent pay almost $500 million in state and local taxes every year. We export almost $200 million to African countries annually, and we expect to generate lifetime earnings of an estimated $388 billion with a projected tax total in payments in Minnesota of $28 billion over our lifetime. We can do better, and we want to do better on behalf of this great state of Minnesota. The Council has engaged in an intensive qualitative and quantitative information gathering system within our community over the last year. This was to learn what is needed from a public policy standpoint to help grow our assets of community and to contribute more to this great state. These engagements have led to the development of community-driven proposals for legislation that we believe moves our state forward with new ideas, innovation, and energy that provides a direction to address the socioeconomic and sociopolitical challenges that Minnesotans of African descent face. These proposals take our community beyond simple constructs or tolerance and appreciating diversity to practicing love of humanity that we all are. One of the community-driven solutions that emerged is the proposal of education legislation that we are discussing today. When you review the test results of Minnesota students on a national achievement test, you may say, Minnesota's doing pretty good. But if you look closely, at the results, you'll notice that these groups of students are not achieving as well as others. As a result, Minnesota has one of the nation's largest achievement gaps. This is not new information. American Indian, Hispanic, and African-American students are graduating from high school at a rate of less than 50%. Many individuals and organizations have studied this problem and offered a number of solutions. One solution that seems to get buried is providing a viable pathway to post-secondary education. Minnesota students need the security of the possibility of post-secondary education through the establishment of a post-secondary tuition endowment. For many students, a college education is not possible. Not because they're not capable, but because they cannot afford it. This realization chokes out the drive for academic success in elementary, junior, and high school. Some may argue that this type of investment is maybe just too expensive, too large. Well, I humbly note that investment in education is the best investment possible because it creates a cycle of increased economic growth. An investment in education leads to educated students, which results in an innovative workforce, which creates a higher tax base, which leads to a more attractive business environment, which in the end creates community wealth. Other states, as Representative Moran mentioned, have implemented varying methods for providing funding for 4 years of post-secondary education. The Georgia Hope Scholarship is one. In Kalamazoo, Michigan, there's the Kalamazoo Promise. This scholarship, funded by private endowment, provides scholarships to students who graduate from Kalamazoo public schools and who are accepted in and enroll in any public State of Michigan University or community college. Researchers studying the impact of the Kalamazoo Promise have found statistically and substantially significant improvement in student achievement and in student behavior. They found a decrease in the number of days spent in suspension by 1 to 3 days per school year, an increase in the GPA of African-American students, a 71% increase in the number of students enrolled in AP classes, which is 166% increase for African-American students, 400% for Latino students, and also a reversal of long-term district enrollment decline. 24 areas around the country have started or are trying to start a promise-style program. We should be number 25. But in Minnesota, we do have the power of you, as Representative Moran mentioned. But it does have some limits, because not every student lives in Minneapolis or St. Paul, and not every student in need attends Minneapolis Public Schools or St. Paul Public Schools, so it could be expanded. Because of this information, I humbly urge you to vote in favor of creating a task force to study the establishment of a post-secondary tuition endowment for the great state of Minnesota. I also request that you recommend this bill for approval to the full House. I'm confident that this will allow Minnesota to take a giant step, a needed step, in eradicating the achievement gap and increase access to higher education for everyone. Thank you for your support of this important issue, and thank you for your commitment to equal access and opportunities for every citizen of this great state of Minnesota.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. McKay. Representative Moran, do you have any other testifiers on behalf of the bill?
No.
Okay. Why don't we, I know we've got a couple of questions, but let me ask if there's anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill. Okay, so with that, why don't we open it up to questions, Representative Erickson, Sandra, and then Representative Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moran, this is an interesting task force. But my question is, in the language on line 1.9 and 1.10, you're talking about this task force that's established would pay tuition of any public school student. So I know that would be regular and charter. Why would you leave out homeschool or even private school students, especially because, you know, when I'm thinking of the minority community, I know they are across spectrums of parental choices. So any comment as to whether or not you would expand that discussion in the task force or amend your language to include, since it says any public school student, especially would it include homeschool students?
Representative Moran.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson. So I'm going to kind of refer that to the council who brought the bill forward. Personally, you know, I believe in choices. I believe that we should create choices so that all our kids and our young people can be successful and have the opportunity to attend college if they choose to. But I'm going to refer why they are not included in this bill to the council. So if we can, I would like to invite Yenny Anderson to the table.
Good morning, Ms. Anderson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please state your name for the record, and I believe you heard the question, and
yes.
Give us your thoughts.
My name is Yende Anderson. That's Y-E-N-D-E, and then Anderson with an O. Thank you, Representative Mariano and Representative Erickson. The reason why it was limited initially to public school students is because we're trying to provide equal access to students who have already been committed to participating in the public education that's provided. Definitely, Representative Moran can amend this, you know, if she chooses, mm-hmm. but it was just for students who are already participating in the public education that's being provided.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
So, Ms. Anderson, could an outstate student then be, of course, the task force is going to have these discussions, but according to the language, any public school student then who gains admission to a public higher educational institution in Minnesota, could that include North Dakota students, Wisconsin? Because I think that's unanswered in this language.
Ms. Anderson.
Thank you. Chairman Mariano and Representative Erickson, I believe that it's just limited to Minnesota public school students, but as you state, this is something that the task force can define more specifically. There's not too many definitions in the bill as it stands because some of the operational issues have to be researched, investigated, and decided on by the task force.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Erickson. And actually on that point, I would certainly encourage the author of the bill to be thinking of perhaps even, and not just leave it to a task force, but be thinking about, so part of the process here is we receive advice and thoughts from others who come at issues a little bit differently. So a couple of issues are on the table. You know, whether it's only public school students, and also in terms of how the language is drafted, whether or not the intent was not meant just for Minnesota students as opposed to others. I think those are very important points that have been made. Representative Wills and Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the testimony. It's definitely an interesting approach, and I know that college costs are an increasing concern for families. So I appreciate Representative Erickson bringing up the questions about making sure it would be available to all students, not just public school students, but also considering that residency piece. And I understand the idea of a task force is to look at those possible ramifications or perimeters, but something to consider if we want to make sure that that's included in the initial language to give those parameters to the task force. So just some thoughts there. But I had a further question on targeting these endowment dollars and just a question on whether it would be based on poverty level at all, or would any student be able to access these dollars? Is that something that would be included in this bill or something maybe looked at in a task force? If you could expound on that.
Ms. Anderson.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. These scholarships are available, some of them have been limited to students in need of that fall into poverty guidelines, and some of them have just been open. And where there is the most success has been in areas where there's been the most access, so that it's not necessarily limited to income, but it's, you know, a student takes their dreams in their hands, so if they're performing well in school, they get accepted into college, they have this opportunity. That's where we have seen the most success. But there are certainly some of them that are limited to income.
Representative Moran.
Okay, sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative. And of course, when the bill was brought to me, that was exactly one of my questions too, because we are really looking at a huge disparity gap. And basically that disparity gap is based on income, at an income level. Low-income family members, children of families who from the low-income community are really facing some high disparities. So I think that may be something that we look at to be more specific and target to better create better outcomes for those populations.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I wanted to follow up on the question that Representative Erickson had regarding the tuition paid by paying for the tuition of any public school student, and how it seems like you had said it was limited to Minnesota only. Chair Mariana, you might have already talked about this. I was engaged in a side conversation, so I didn't quite hear it, but it looks like it's open to anyone outside of Minnesota, and if I could encourage the author at some point to really limit it to Minnesota kids, I'll tell you exactly the reason why. I have two kids in college myself, and over the last session, I really dug deep into the tuition paid by U of M students, both Minnesota residents who go to the U of M and also non-resident Minnesotans who go to the U of M. And there's a really, really tiny disparity between what outstate non-Minnesota residents pay and what Minnesota kids pay. It's like $5,000, $6,000 a year. And that is so far different than almost any other university I've seen, to the point where Minnesota kids and their parents who pay taxes are really subsidizing the tuition for non-Minnesota kids. We're already doing that. If you add up all the taxes paid by Minnesota taxpayers, you add the tuition paid by Minnesota kids attending, that's a much higher amount than what kids from North Dakota, South Dakota, Illinois, New York pay for tuition at the U of M. And I believe that's wrong. So this bill, I believe, really needs to limit it to Minnesota kids, because the non-Minnesota kids are already getting an endowment, whether they, you know, it's just not seen on the tuition they pay. So I would leave that as a word of encouragement. If you have any thoughts, I'd be happy to hear it.
And I believe, Representative Barrett, the Georgia program that was referenced is a Georgia student-only program. I'm not familiar with the Kansas program. One could argue that an investment of any student anywhere that chooses to remain in Minnesota winds up being an investment in Minnesota, and that's certainly a feature of many higher ed nodes across the country. But I think Representative Barrett is sort of reinforcing a message that I'm hearing from a number of members here about being able to target the bill specifically for Minnesota residents. Representative Leidinger, then Representative Precia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we know how many endowments we currently have at the university? And let me try to explain what I'm driving towards, because I'm a little unfamiliar with what we currently have in place. And what this bill does is it, you know, I realize it's establishing a task force, but these organizations can spring up anytime and anywhere by any organization to establish some sort of an endowment. And I'm sure that there's many of them already in place. So what I want to then is kind of get what you're really trying to do here. Is this supposed to be public funding that's going to end up coming into this thing? Are you envisioning that this task force is going to set something up that then is going to be additional public money that's going to be dumped into this, or are we, or is this going to be something that an endowment that's going to sit out there and then try to attract private dollars that goes into it? I'm just a little, because that's my understanding of these things is that that's how it normally works. You know, we go on out, we get the business community to come and support an endowment for a specific cause. I mean, we get outside dollars. Or is this, or is your thinking is this is just, this is going to be more public money doing this? Could you just shed more light on that, please?
And members, the motion before us is to move this bill, if it's successfully moved, to the Higher Ed Committee, where those kind of questions are much more under their appropriate domain. However, it's a legitimate question, and so, but I'm just kind of encouraging us not to spend tons of time dissecting higher ed financing in this committee. Representative Moran.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I know what has been done in Georgia, and so often we look at our lottery sales, our tickets, and a portion that should go to education. So, I mean, that is one thought that we can look at ways to fund this endowment. But again, I think it's pretty much open to the task force to come to some type of solution about what's the best way to handle this, which is why we want to create the task force.
Ms. Sanders.
Representative, thank you, Mr. Chairman. These scholarships have been funded over all in different states and communities different ways. For example, in Georgia, as Representative Moran just discussed, they fund the scholarship through the lottery sales, lottery ticket sales. In Kalamazoo, they fund the scholarship through private endowments. In Tennessee, it's all public funding. So it just it depends on what a state can do, and that's why we would like the task force to look into this and see what can Minnesota do to provide equal access to all students to post-secondary education. It may end up, and we were looking for them to make recommendations. It may be they come up with a public-private partnership or just a private endowment. We don't know at this point what their recommendations would be.
Just as a quick follow-up. So do we have to have a law to do this? I mean, can't the schools, I mean, they're doing this already. Why do we have to legislate to have them do this? I don't understand, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair and Representative, who is the they that's doing it?
The university?
Statewide.
And MNSCU? That's, they're organized. They have people on staff to do these kinds of things, and it's done all the time, is my understanding. I just kind of, somebody help me here. Why? Why are we doing this?
Representative Leidinger, I think we heard in the opening the why for this. I think you're asking more about whether or not this matches up with current decisions being made in the Higher Ed Committee. And again, members, I would encourage that that conversation be held in the Higher Ed Committee. I think the question before us here is whether or not, and frankly, the bill is here because it requires the Commissioner of the Department of Education to convene this task force. And I don't want to crimp our conversation, but I also don't want to get us into the work of the Higher Ed Committee here. Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. And just a pro tip, if you're looking for money, I wouldn't go to the e-poll tabs.
Why? Good advice, Representative.
My question, Chair Mariani, have you consulted with the other councils, for example, the Council of Latino Affairs, with Hector Garcia? I mean, a lot of respect for him and the other organizations. Have you sought their advice and their counsel on this as well?
Representative Moran.
I'm going to pass that to the council.
Ms. Anderson.
Chairman and Representative, we did present this bill to the other councils. They're all very supportive of it. But you have to remember also that I guess I say this respectfully, that the council is charged under the legislation 3.9225 to bring forth recommendations from the African community. So this idea bubbled up from a community process, and we did share everything with all the councils, and they are in support of this. In fact, the Latino Council does a lot. CLAC does a lot with education, so we did seek their input.
on this.
And Representative Moran, as your bill is written, even though the bill arises from the Council of Black Minnesotans, it actually is written for all students, regardless of race or socioeconomic background.
Mr. Chair, you are correct, for all students.
Representative Christian.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, and thank you for that clarification. And I think that's important because, as I sit on the state gov, we look at this in the budget. Sometimes there can be a little bit of back and forth on those councils, so we want to make sure there's collaboration as you move forward. A second question that I have, and you may not have the answer, but is there any intent at all on citizenship or length of time in school for a student? So has those considerations been brought forth? I know that can be a hot topic, and we want to make sure that we're at least talking those through in the debate process.
Representative Moran.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not too sure if we debated citizenship, but what we do know is that this bill is open to our intent. I think the council intent was to have this available for all Minnesota students who have attended a public school in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Christian.
And thank you, Chair Mariani. And with all due respect, that's my clarification. Is that a Minnesota student who's been there for 1 week? Is that a Minnesota student who has been there for a couple years? These are some of the questions that I think we want to make sure we do the right way or have that conversation and set the expectations. For example, in my area in Long Prairie, I have a very high population of Hispanic and Latinos, and they've worked very hard to move through the ranks of citizenship, and I would hate for them to miss out on an opportunity for someone that came in a short time. So I just want to have those conversations. Any thoughts on clarification?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the guidelines would be a resident of the state of Minnesota. If there are a resident, whatever that timeline is to become a resident, that would be the indicator of this bill.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. And just for clear, any consideration on citizenship? I get the difference, but I just want to make sure I understand the question or ask the question.
Representative Moran, I believe Representative Quisha is obviously the language before us is not explicit on these points, but
correct.
I think he's appropriately asking for what the intent is of the bill. And obviously, we don't have amendments before us, but if this bill were to move forward, those might be the subject of amendments in a following committee. So
thank you for the clarification, Chair.
I think you're doing an appropriate job of trying to make sure we have the right parameters around this. Representative Moran.
Yep, Mr. Chair, Representative, I mean, there are great questions, and we have not vetted all these questions, so we are really open to hearing how we can improve it as it moves on.
Representative Nordis.
I guess I just had a question. Do you have any idea how many students we're talking about that maybe would be out there looking for this help, and how much money that's going to take in the end if this moves forward and is successful? Any estimate at all?
Mr. Chair, no, we do not have those numbers.
Representative Moran, I suspect that the bill would generate a fiscal note at some point. Or perhaps not. It all depends on how this thing will be structured. We have the power review, model, which I believe does not require. Actually, I should check that. I'm not sure. There might be a fiscal note that might arise out of that. That Representative Nordis with that answer, perhaps make an attempt to answer your question on finance.
And that's fine. I was just going to make a comment that M-State is located in my community. And they've got a very large endowment they've had for many years, probably one of the largest for a two-year college. And it's very successful and helps a lot of students. So we already are using that vehicle to kind of pay down the tuition that they're having to pay. So.
That's terrific. Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. I like the message in this bill. I think it's aspirational in many ways, and I think points to the issue where we often talk about the achievement gap, but in many cases it's an opportunity gap. And I know from my experience working with at-risk students, and I remember testimony we heard when we did consider the power of you, students talking about not realizing that there was a path for them to go to college. And I think you're setting that up as a way for students to say, I can get there. And students that I worked with oftentimes needed to be confronted when they would see, why should I try? There's no pathway for me. There's no opportunity for me. Why should I try? And I think we'd go a long way in dealing with what we call the achievement gap if we'd made sure that students could see that aspirational aspect of this. And so I really am pleased to see you bring this forward. Did you cite some research that showed these kinds of programs in other states did have an effect on achievement gaps?
Professor Moran, I believe Mr. Mackay did share some outcomes related to scholarships, endowment supports, in addition to what we currently do.
I do have some other statistics that I can share with you, too, regarding the Georgia Hope Scholarship Program. SAT scores have risen by 40 points since that was enacted, and the enrollment of black students in Georgia's colleges and universities has increased by 70%.
Thank you.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In my short time here in the House, one of the things that I've really enjoyed is really beginning to understand how this whole process works and getting kind of some of the nuances down. And I think that what I really like about this bill, and I'm one of the signers on it, is that it's a really nice marriage of activists and citizens who know a lot about things that we're not always in touch with every day, advising the legislature on some really good ideas in a way that we understand. And I really think that's what makes this bill so important to me, is that it's just a really wonderful connection between citizens and the government, and where we can giving us eyes in areas where we don't always have eyes in because we're not in those neighborhoods. And the second thing that I like about the way this process works is and kind of answering the question to Representative Leidinger, is that in really providing us with that understanding of what needs to be done next. I don't think the bill would be here if it was being done in a way that really reflects the things we're trying to accomplish. And so for me, it gives us that chance to talk about it in a policy sense, but then it also gives it life to answer the next set of questions, which I think were really good questions about how we look at who is the population and also how we look at way higher education approaches it. So I'm really pleased with it, and I'm excited to watch this bill mature as it goes through the different committees, and I'm very thankful to be allowed to be part of the advocacy for this group. So I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Sir Wells, you get the last committee word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
There's a question there.
I was reading through the language, and I had an additional question on the report. The commissioner shall report to the respective legislative committees by December 31st, 2014. And I have a concern with that date, just with elections coming up this year, with changeover in committee assignments, changeover of members. If this goes forward and we have a task force report, I would want to make sure that that report was delivered to the legislative body for the 2015 session. So if we could address that, I think that would be very helpful in moving forward.
Very well. Good advice. members, we're going to vote on the bill. My only 2 cents on it is that one of the things that has strongly fallen under the purview, obviously here we're overlapping two committees here, and quite frankly one that is primarily a higher ed committee discussion. However, one of the things that we've been working awfully hard on for a number of years through different political administration has been toward a career and college readiness approach to our work. And so part of what's happening in Minnesota is that as opposed to solely depending on post-secondary to be able to produce the outcomes that we want, we've been working awfully hard to expand those kind of outcomes while students are still in the secondary, at least in their secondary experience. And if this were to move forward, a task force, you know, were created, I would encourage you, Representative Moran, to make sure that the task force takes that into consideration as well. You know, our growth in PSEO, CIS, and other rigorous post-secondary experiences for younger people are steadily rising, and we want to continue to grow that as well. And you've heard some big questions around residency, public only, income parameters, and Representative Leidinger raised questions about, you know, making sure that we're not being redundant, if you will, relative to opportunities for financial support for students. So I would encourage you to, if the bill moves forward, to be thinking strongly around those kind of parameters as possible amendments for this bill. With that, the chair renews his motion that House File 2133. We have these new motions nowadays. I want to make sure I get it correct. Yeah. I don't have to my language. Turning my paper over. Here we go. Be re-referred to the Committee on Higher Education Policy and Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Moran. You have a lot of work ahead of you, but thank you for bringing us this bill. Thank you, Mr. McKay and Ms. Anderson. Representative Slocum, House File 2326. The chair moves House File 2326 be referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Members, we are scheduled to adjourn at 11:30. I will certainly entertain an opportunity to move a little bit beyond that in order to continue today's work. However, if we were unable to do that, we will recess and then reconvene later this evening. Just so you're aware of that. Representative Slocum, the chair has moved your bill. If you can tell us about your bill and introduce your testifiers, and we'll get going.
I will do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. This bill offers you an opportunity because we're concerned about our graduation rate, and this bill allows gets more kids to graduation. It also addresses a very specific need in our schools.
Thank you.
And a need that has been underfunded for a number of years. The fact of the matter is we used to have 9 recovery schools, and we'll talk more about what a recovery school is, but 9 recovery schools 5 years ago. We now have 4. So while the population does ebb and flow because it's a situation where someone comes into a recovery school, does the work that they need to do to augment their recovery from substance abuse, and then does credit recovery, does what they need to do, and then oftentimes moves into a traditional high school or charter public school, another school. Some kids graduate from the recovery school. My neighbor across the street, his son, delightful kid, had some problems with substance abuse, primarily alcohol. And we had a great graduation party that I was lucky enough to be invited to last spring. He graduated from his recovery school. Anyway, what this bill does is it defines approved recovery schools to mean a course of instruction offered by a school that provides academic services, assistance with recovery from substance abuse, and continuing care to students. A recovery program has to be approved by the MDE, so it's not something that just sprouts up. It goes through an approval process that's fairly rigorous. This bill also provides funding to cover the cost of alcohol and chemical dependency counselors, licensed school counselors, licensed school psychologists, licensed school nurses, and licensed school social workers. Why? Because these are kids that are generally, oftentimes, are in a fair degree of crisis, fair to severe degree of crisis, and need the additional support to succeed in their schooling. The bill also raises the pupil weight from 1.2 to 1.7 ADM for students spending additional time in an approved recovery program. And it also provides transportation, because transportation has been one of the stumbling blocks and barriers to kids successfully attending and completing their what they needed to do in a recovery program. With that, I'd like you do have a handout, I believe, that gives you additional information in your packet about what recovery schools do. They're pretty remarkable little programs. Anyway, I have two testifiers. I have Leah Dahl, who's the Area Learning Center Operations Principal in Intermediate District 287. And I have Amber, who's a student in the Inside Program in the White Bear Lake Area Learning Center.
Thank you both, and good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee. Who's going to go first?
Okay, I'm going to go first, and I'm going to try to keep my remarks brief. Thank you, Tara Mariani. Thank you, committee members, for allowing us to testify here today. My name's Lee Dahl, and I'm an Area Learning Center Operations Principal at 287. 287 is a collaborative of many or multiple school districts, 12 in the suburban Hennepin County area, including Osseo and Edina and Minnetonka and Richfield, and just to name a few. I'm testifying, however, on behalf of all the recovery schools in Minnesota struggling with the addiction, students that are struggling with addiction and chemical recovery issues. You need only pick up a newspaper most days to read about the influx of heroin and other addictive drugs and the serious damage that they're causing, often life-threatening, for our young people statewide. At the same time, drug availability and use is on the rise. Our high school programs to support these students in recovery are declining sharply. As Representative Slocum said, in 2009 there were 13 schools, last year there were 7 schools, and this year there are 4 recovery schools. We've gone from 490 seats available to 128 seats available in 5 years. At the district where I work, 287, we have opened and closed, and I've been there many years, 3 recovery schools over the years, each of them in operation for 4 or more years. But ultimately, we had to close these schools. And they closed not because we didn't believe in the mission or because there wasn't a need. They closed because the resources needed to address this population are beyond what is currently available in regular K-12 education funding. And that's how ALCs are funded. Students in recovery, like their peers, need to work on credit attainment for graduation, and usually this means re-enrolling in their regular high schools, but sometimes going back to the environment that you just came from can lead to going into the same situation and falling back into the addiction and to the use. So the temptation is there, and sadly too overwhelming for some young people, and that's why typically kids in recovery schools go to treatment 3 or more times. To stay on the path to graduation, students in recovery need to stay sober. And to stay sober, they need a clean start and a clean school. They need a peer recovery community that understands and is sympathetic. They need access to chemical dependency counselors, social workers to provide tools and guidance. And often they need transportation and extra focus to make up the graduation credits and make up for lost time. Recovery schools are mentioned as a promising practice in both the state and federal drug control policies. Recovery schools often offer students grades 7 through 12 a safe, sober place with the necessary communities to support them. And yes, we have had 7th graders as young as 12 in the programs. These students need both equally recovery support and education support. Recovery schools work true miracles in the lives of young people and their families every day, and it's heartbreaking to close one for the families, for the teachers, and especially for the students. But recovery schools need to offer these services in order for the recovering students to be successful. And often the schools suffer from financial struggles and ultimately have to close. In a typical year, 5,500 students between 12 and 18 years of age go through substance abuse dependency treatment programs in Minnesota. With only 4 schools left and 128 seats, about 2% of those kids will have an access to go to a recovery-type program. So for the vast majority of students in recovery, we offer not a lot of help and less hope. So clearly, the recovery schools face a tentative future, and we may be even past tentative. The Minnesota Recovery School Task Force is working to ensure, and you have a letter from them in front of you, that recovery schools are a viable educational option for students in chemical dependency recovery. But the endorsement's not enough. If we truly want to improve the outcomes for our young people who have made the brave choice to embrace recovery, it's extremely important to keep recovery schools open and available. Today I'm here to implore your committee to consider supporting House File 2326, which would allow Minnesota Recovery Schools the financial support they need to serve young people who very much want to reclaim a sober, healthy life. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Dahl. And Amber, I guess you're up next. So look forward to, to hearing from you.
Good morning, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to share my story today. Why I came to Insight? Why I came to Insight was because, well, I knew I wasn't going to be able to maintain my sobriety after I got out of treatment in 2012, the summer of 2012, without the chemical and the educational help I needed. I was behind, really behind in my educational credits, and but also I needed that moral. I needed the sober part of it too. I needed the sobriety help because I knew that if I went back to my home school, that I would not be able to maintain sobriety. Why I chose to stay. This past summer of 2013, I was supposed to return to my home school, Park High School in Cottage Grove. I chose not to because I knew that it was only going to be a matter of, you know, hours before I wouldn't be able to maintain my sobriety anymore, and that my credits were also behind at that school. I would have to, if I returned to Park, that I would have to be going another year, and this is my senior year this year, and I'd have to be attending four nights of night school. Why it is important in recovery schools to have support with chemical health. The support with chemical health is very, very, very important to me and to the to my fellow students at Insight. It's a great support system to have a chemical counselor there. It helps tremendously. Someone to talk to and someone to always be there, you know, when you're struggling with things. Counselors and social workers is also a very, very, very strong reason that, you know, we should have them there. Transportation, that's a fun one for me. I live in Cottage Grove, Minnesota. I'm going to school in White Bear Lake, and I used to have to take three city buses to get to school. I would have to wake up at between 4:30 and 5 in the morning, and I'd have to walk a mile down to my bus stop and transfer, get on the bus and then transfer to the parking lot in Cottage Grove. Then I'd have to transfer from downtown St. Paul to the Maplewood Mall in Maplewood, and then I would have to transfer again to my school, which I had to walk a couple of blocks to get to my school also. The total times that I spent daily on a bus, one way it was about 2.5 hours total. That was probably around 5.5 hours that I spent on my bus. But, you know, I know for a fact that if it wasn't for Insight, I would not be sober today. So thank you again, committee, for listening to my story, and I'm open to any questions.
Thank you, Amber, and I am inspired by your story, and I speak for all of us here, and I want to commend you for your focus and your commitment to your education and to the betterment of your life, and I wish you continued success as you stay focused on those things that call you to be a good person, a good citizen, and a good student. So thank you. Members, we have a couple of members who have, I'm sorry, Representative Slocum, is there anyone else who wish to, okay, is there anyone who wishes to testify for or against the bill in the audience? If not, we have Representative Isaacson and Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, Amber, thanks for being here today. When I was 17 years old, I dropped out of high school. And I had to go to treatment myself, but this would have been long before you were born, back in 1989. And I've been clean ever since, but I can tell you that had I not had the sources for recovery in an alternative high school that looked at education much differently than my high school did, there's no way I'd be sitting here either today. I'm sure that I'd be dead. And so I can't speak enough to the importance of this kind of thing. I can tell you that if I didn't have, it isn't just enough to just quit. It's about putting a culture in the community around you that nurtures and supports what you're trying to accomplish. And if you don't have that, it's just not going to be, the chances of young people in recovery are much worse than the chances of people that are older. And so it's double important to get those folks there. And so I just can't stress enough how important a bill like this is, and that we need to take this kind of opportunity seriously, because it really does hit at the core of helping people that would, like myself, been much more involved in trouble and make us on the right side of the road. And so thank you so much for your guys' testimony in the bill, and I'm excited to see this pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Isaacson. And I note from my notes that in the last 4 years we've lost a number of these high schools across the state. Representative Barrett and Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Amber, just thank you so much for being here today and telling us your story. Mm-hmm. I'm a co-author on the bill with Representative Slocum because of people like you and really the thousands of people that you represent. As the other testifier said, there's about 5,500 people or so that access treatment who are young kids. Only about 120 could go to the sober schools because they're declining. I mean, there's thousands more kids who unfortunately aren't getting treated and are out there in our population really not doing the things they could be doing. They're not reaching their potential. So I support the bill strongly for many reasons. I won't go into all of them, but the chronic nature of the disease is such that anyone in treatment, much less a young person who has other challenges as well, really needs a strong, supportive, safe environment in which to learn and to understand the addiction and how to overcome it. So I strongly support the bill. Thank you, Amber, for being here today, and I look forward to its success. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Barrett, and thank you for your services over the years, both here but also in your non-elected life and commitment to these issues. Representative Yaruso and then Wills, and then members will vote. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Morgan, Yaruso and Wills. Representative Morgan, he gave me that look, too. Like,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that.
Me, man?
Just a little bird over here. Amber, thanks very much for coming down, and thank you, Representative Slocum, for carrying this bill. I have one brief comment on the first page of the bill on lines 21 and 22 when you talk about the transportation aid. And by the way, Amber, that's one heck of a story about how you have to get to school. I wish we could work on doing something about that, but not here in this committee. As we go to the next committee, Representative Slocum, you have provided by Metro Transit. I just wanted to point out that there are significant portions of Dakota County and Scott County and Western Hennepin County that are not served at all by Metro Transit. So I'm not sure what changes have to be made in that. I think the Suburban Transit Association, maybe I can help get you in touch with somebody there who can help us make that more applicable to the entire Seven County Metro. But thank you very much for carrying the bill.
Representative Yaruso and then Wells.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just have a comment. I realize this is outside the scope of the bill as it's written, but it occurred to me as I was listening that as a teacher, I've had experience with a number of students who struggled with eating disorders, and people who have eating disorders share many of the same challenges as students who are struggling with substance addictions. And I really wonder whether we shouldn't look into whether there is a place for inclusion of people with eating disorders in the existing programs or establishment of other programs, because currently the alternatives are kind of almost all or nothing for kids with serious eating disorders. They're either in hospital treatment or in these intensive day programs, or they're kind of on their own with maybe a weekly visit to somebody. And I think they could really benefit from the same kind of supportive environment.
Thank you. Representative Wills, you get the last word again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for your testimony today, and Amber, I really appreciate you sharing your story. And Representative Morgan touched on it a little bit. I had a question also about the transit and the provision in the bill. And Ms. Dahl, you mentioned that some of the students are fairly young as 12. And I guess my concern is, are 12-year-olds going to be taking Metro Transit? Is there maybe an alternative option for younger students? Is that something that you're looking at?
Ms. Dahl.
Thank you. Sorry, I'm jumping ahead. Thank you. The 12-year-old is the anomaly. That's not your typical situation. And if we had a middle school student, we'd certainly work hard with the school district that was referring to try to get them on some kind of a bus situation. If they're in high school, though, we try to work with Metro Transit as much as we can, realizing, though, that some of the western suburbs have very limited transportation services. But we would, for younger kids, we would have to have those protections in place. Yes.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. I just think it's very important to be concerned about the younger students. And with Amber describing the route that she had to take, I wanted to make sure our younger students were taken care of. So thank you.
And I think that, the thing that we get sad about is when the students aren't able to figure out the three buses to get there. I mean, we're losing kids. So thank you.
Thank you. Members, we will now vote on the bill. The chair renews a motion that House File 2326 be re-referred to the Committee on Education and Finance. All in favor of that, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you. Okay. Representative Slocum, Amber, thank you. Continue good luck and stay at it. We're very proud of you. And thank you, Ms. Dahl. Representative Dabney, the last bill, House File 2272. Representative Dabney moves that House File 2270. Wait a minute, let me get this right. Where is it? Is it this one? Oh, I'm sorry. All right. Representative Dabney moves that House File 2272 be referred to the Committee on Education and Finance. Representative Dabney. Representative Dabney, we're 5 minutes from adjourning. I think. I think you're going to need more than 5 minutes, but who knows? You've pulled rabbits out of the hat before. I've served with you long enough to know that you're quite capable of that. However, the chair will keep us here to have a thoughtful conversation. My hope is that we can act on this bill before we adjourn here this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am then in the unenviable position of being between everyone and lunch.
Yeah.
So thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2272 is an attempt to add greater transparency and accountability to the contracting out system when Minnesota school districts choose to contract out for services that they currently provide with their own staff. It establishes a consistent statewide process for school districts to evaluate the total value and impact of contracting out for routine school services. These would be things like the food service, janitorial services, busing, that sort of thing. It does not include contracts that are already in place for services, supervisory, professional, or confidential services, or for contracts with a dollar value of under $25,000. In evaluating contracting out services currently performed by district employees, House File 2272 asks districts to explore both the short and long-term costs in determining the best value. It does assure any new employees that they will receive similar wage and benefit packages as the current employees receive, who they are replacing, assuring that the community that workers and families in that community can continue to remain independent and not become reliant on government services to supplement their total compensation from a private employer. School districts are free to contract out for services currently provided in-house after determining that by doing so they will save more than 5% of their current costs. This assures that the negative effects of a contracting out on the local taxpaying community are balanced by the projected savings. In looking to renew House File 2272, House File 2272 directs districts to do their due diligence in reviewing the actual contracting costs versus projected costs when the contract was signed, the quality of the service provided, and how wage and benefit costs compare to district-provided services. Lastly, House File 2272 allows districts to rebid service contracts found to have fallen short in cost savings or service quality if the district can demonstrate that the cost of bringing those services back in-house is greater than 110% of the current costs they're experiencing. With me today is Val Rolstead from SEIU.
Good morning, Ms. Ralstead. Please
Good
state
morning.
Your name for the record and give us your testimony.
I'm Valerie Ralstead. I'm a special ed educational assistant in the Columbia Heights School District. I'm also a resident of the school district, and my children, all three of them, went through, and I also graduated from Columbia Heights School District. So I'm very invested in my district. And for the quality and the transparency of having quality people working in the school district besides teachers, the support staff in a district is also very important to the student. Sometimes the bus driver is the first person that student sees, and the consistency that that bus driver gives that student is very important. My story is when I went to school, I got bused by a bus driver in the community. My oldest daughter was also had the same driver. He knew the route. He knew the community. My son, in his years, ended up with, because the school district, when transportation prices went up and school districts had financial strife, we had in-house busing, and we had to let it go. They brought in First Student and contracted, and, of course, they gave us a good deal the first year. Second year, of course, it went up. My son would come home, and he's in high school, so he knows how driving restrictions are and how the roads are and everything. He would come home and say, oh, the bus driver blew through this stop sign. Or the bus driver, you know, he doesn't know where he's going. We had to take a route, you know, way out of the way, and I'm on the bus for an hour. It's a two-mile radius. He should not have to be coming home a half hour, 45 minutes late. So the quality that we are asking that school districts look at, we need to have that. Our students need to have that quality. And, you know, the lunch ladies, I remember going, and my girlfriend's mother was the lunch lady. A lot of times that's what who's in the community and working. And those people are taking the time and effort and knowing the children's names. Contracting out, sometimes you will have turnover, you know, monthly. That's not the quality we want our students to have. We want them to have the best education and to be fed and driven and have the buildings cleaned by people that care for them and for our community and our school district. And I thank you for your support on this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Wolstad. Representative Dabney, do you have any other testifiers?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Are there any members of the audience that wish to testify on the bill? If so, please come forward. Good morning. We'll have to either add chairs or play musical chairs. Good morning, Ms. Kelleher and Ms. Dulslin.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent every school district in the state of Minnesota, and we are here expressing concerns about this bill going forward. I could go on for a while, but I'll try to summarize them. We believe that school districts have a financial responsibility to spend taxpayer dollars properly, economically, efficiently, and we feel that this would lead to inefficient, uneconomical, and use of funds. This bill makes contracting for services impossible or nearly impossible because it eliminates any labor cost savings by requiring service contractors to provide the same or better wage or benefit and retirement packages as those already in place. Basically, the school district is losing the opportunity to manage costs. On that, it does require a significant amount of tracking if a vendor would come into place. The question is, do we have the technology and the programs to do that? It also requires policing up the contracts and administration of additional areas of which we don't keep track of now. And in the end, this would protect employees, certainly. But the question is this best for students across the state? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Callahan. Ms. Dosland.
Good morning, members of the committee and Mr. Chair. My name is Valerie Dosland, and I represent the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials. We have a number of concerns with the bill, and I continue am working on getting some more detailed feedback from NASBO members who were not able to be there today. But I think in the year legislative cycle that's termed the unsession, I think this is contrary to that stated goal that Governor Dayton had and that I've heard many of you at the table lay out in your prior to the start of session. I think House File 2272 limits flexibility and presumes that school districts are not trying to find the best cost services and the best services to meet the needs of their school district and their students. I think the requirements of the bill, my MASBO members have said that the requirements of the bill are overly burdensome and prescriptive. And with all due respect to my good friend, Representative Jim Dabney, I think this is a good example of decision-making at the Capitol rather than allowing locally elected school boards to make decisions locally. And I think if folks are unhappy with decisions that are made at the local level, that's why we have locally elected school boards. And I think another concern about this, I think, again, it presumes that districts aren't being thoughtful and that they aren't trying to make as fiscally responsible decisions. And the reality is every penny counts. I'm not really sure where the 5% threshold came of savings. You know, 1% of savings is important. I had a school district come and testify in support of a bill over in the Senate that if it should pass would save them $6,000. $6,000 is not a lot of money in the grand scheme of things, but that $6,000 would have bought 100 hours of tutoring. So I will continue to talk with Representative Dabney about this bill, but it just raises a lot of concerns. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and if you have any questions, I'm certainly available.
Thank you. Members, we are distributing a letter from C. Mr. Lundell had stopped in my office earlier, not able to be here because he's, I believe, testifying in another committee. But I had indicated that we would make sure we share his letter with the committee members. Questions, members? Representative Benson and then Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may not be a specific question directed to two testifiers, but one of the concerns I have when we get into kind of a trend, an issue related in a way to this, which is the debate over raising the minimum wage. At some point, I'd like to hear what the School Boards Association view is on that. And the reason I'm asking the question is because one of the problems we've been having with the debate over minimum wage is, at least to me, is that when people are paid a lower than living wage, it tends then to put pressure on what we call our safety net. We're having to spend taxpayers' money subsidizing, whether it's a private business or a government institution, in a sense, because we are providing then food stamps, we're providing assistance for rent, housing, those kinds of issues, health care. And many of my colleagues in this legislature are interested in trying to reduce those kinds of pressures on taxpayers. And in a sense, I agree with them, because a decent wage allows us to reduce some of these government taxpayer expenditures. And so I tend to support Representative Dabney's proposal on those grounds. I would like to see that this legislature always work to encourage employment, encourage working for a wage, rather than depending more and more on the public safety net. And your opposition to the bill, to me, sends us in the direction I'd rather see us move away from. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And actually, I didn't catch Mr. Bartholomew. He was trying to make his way up to the testimony table. I apologize, but he has requested to be heard as well. So, Mr. Bartholomew?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The testifiers, don't wander too far because we do have a couple of questions still.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, members, my name's Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and certainly appreciate the efforts of Representative Dabney, but wanted to mention we have several concerns with House File 2272 as well, primarily because it removes a great deal of discretion that local school boards have in deciding if and under what conditions they may choose to contract for services. As has been mentioned, the school board's decision to contract for services is not easy, nor is it done lightly. And this local decision is based on a variety of factors, including cost management and improved services. If a key responsibility for a local school board is to make decisions based on what's most cost-effective, why would Subdivision 2 Clause B take the unusual action of specifying that a potential service provider must offer the same or higher wages, health benefits, and retirement benefits? Not only does this impact the school district, but it also dictates compensation, including retirement benefits, for service providers. We also have concerns with the language in Subdivision 3, Clause B, which governs the renewal of service contracts, especially lines 3.17 through 3.19. As we read this language, it would cap the cost of future contract renewals at a level set potentially 2, 4, or perhaps more years previously. Again, we have several concerns with House File 272, but central to those is a concern over this being an overreach by the state in determining what options local school boards can consider in best meeting their unique needs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dabney, this to me, as a former school board member, looks to me like a solution in search of a problem. I have some serious concerns about the bind you're going to put small school districts in. There's a lot of issues in here, much as our testifiers have described. But what are you looking to solve when we're doing this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Keel, thank you. What we're trying to engage with the school boards is a conversation about the impact of their choices when they choose to contract out on the community that they're serving. Representative Benson raised the issue, and I tried to in my opening remarks as well. You may contract out the services and save some immediate dollars. We're asking that you also look longer term, so short-term and long-term, at the impact. But does that mean that your loyal employees now are laid off who likely live in the community? You know, it might be the mom who'd been staying at home with the children who's now coming in for a few hours a day to be one of the lunch ladies. She now gets laid off, negative impact on that family. Are the employees brought in paid at wages that continue to make them eligible for public services, where the state then is subsidizing that private employer? We see private employers who intentionally manipulate the number of hours that employees are allowed to work to keep them below a threshold at which they qualify for health insurance, for instance, for themselves and their families. Well, that has a net negative impact on the community that that district is serving. So we're asking that school boards look at both the short and long-term impact of their choices to contract out.
I see where you're coming from. I'm trying not to be offended because I know how hard school boards work to employ and work on those, whether we do contracted, I've done both. We like the flexibility because sometimes I can think of our, when we hired a chemical dependency counselor, she did not want to be contracted or part of the school system. She had a private contract, and it worked best for her. You know, when I think about food service, we didn't do this in our school district, but the university did it. They turned right around and hired all of those people who were working for the food service originally. Those were the first contracts that they picked up. You know, as far as minimum wage goes, I can't think of an instance where that was even that was a discussion. We weren't even close to that. I just really, my real concern here is that I've got small schools in my district that don't necessarily, can't do these things like would be required. Sometimes they share services between schools. And I think we are looking to tie their hands to be effective in smaller districts. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Representative Lighting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Dabney, how is this going to help the graduation rate? And how, I mean, we're at 78%. How is this going to help the minority graduation rate? I mean, by pulling, you know, policy into St. Paul and not allowing the districts to go out and do what they need to do to accomplish their mission, which is produce good prospects that are going to come on out and do something in the world today. I think we're going in the wrong direction, the absolute wrong direction. If we should do anything, we should give the districts more leeway to accomplish their mission, which is to produce good graduates, good graduate level. This is just a wrong-headed bill. That's what I think.
Mr. Chair? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Leidinger, I think there is a correlation here between this bill and the graduation rate. As Representative Moran testified in presenting her bill, what we know is that graduation and family income are highly correlated. A family that is stable with parents that are working and able to provide for their children both financially and in terms of access to health insurance and the like is a family that is stronger and in a better position to support their children and their academics and more likely to get to graduation. So having school service personnel who are able to do that and not rely on government services, remain stable in their homes and their students is a strength to the graduation rate. As the testifier indicated and explained from her own experience, the consistency in the relationships that school service providers are able to develop with students can be key in a strong school climate, whether it's the bus driver I meet at the beginning of the day and say goodbye to at the end of the day, or the lunch lady who I have a particular warm relationship with, or anyone else in the building. They may be a key relationship in my getting to school, staying in school, and achieving. So stability in those staffing patterns is also a variable in getting to a better graduation rate in Minnesota.
Representative Erickson, Sandra.
Mr. Chair, I'll pass. Some of us have to get going.
Representative Barrett.
Mr. Chair, I'll pass too.
Representative Cresha.
I'll pass.
Representative Dabney.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. Some have alluded to offense. My apologies, Representative Keel, no offense intended. But I do think there's an underlying question here as to why the state would want a consistent process across districts for a transparent and accountable procedure for when districts are looking to contract out for services. First, because I think taxpayers deserve a public, transparent, and accountable process for school board decisions. Secondly, and perhaps most importantly, I would remind members of the committee that on average, every dollar spent in a school district, 78 cents of that comes from the state. 22 cents comes from local levy. So when we look at what is our role, if we're sending almost 80 cents out of every dollar, I think it's reasonable for us to ask that there be a open, public, consistent, transparent process for when districts choose to contract out. They may still do it, but that's open, consistent, and transparent. And with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'd ask for your support.
Representative Dabney, earlier we heard about a 5% versus a 1% threshold. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit more about why 5% as opposed to 1% or 10%.
Certainly.
Are there some metrics here? Is it that are tied to some rubrics or just any kind of information that would help me?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, I think the 5% is the margin that assures taxpayers in the community that the quality of services provided will be the same if they're contracted out, and that the impact on the community will be muted from any potential negative impacts of layoffs, re-employment at lower wage rates, and that sort of thing. So it just represents that we all have the experience. I can buy the cheapest used car out there, but on a winter like this, it might not have gotten me through. And maybe spending a little bit more would have given me more reliable transportation.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Dabney. With that, the Representative Dabney renews his motion that House File 2272, that's the correct number, right?
And Mr. Chair, I'd ask for a roll call.
And a roll call being asked, the clerk will take the roll call. Representative Dabney renews his motion that House File 2272 be re-referred to the Committee on Education and Finance. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
Yes.
Vice Chair Barnett? Representative Erickson?
No.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Barrett?
No.
Representative Benson?
Yes.
Representative Bly?
Yes.
Representative Dabney?
Yes.
Representative Roger Erickson?
Yes.
Representative Faust? Representative Isaacson?
Yes.
Representative Keel?
No.
Representative Kreischer?
No.
Representative Leidiger?
Absolutely no.
Representative Marquardt?
Yes.
Representative Morgan?
Yes.
Representative Nornes?
No.
Representative Sawatsky?
Yes.
Representative Erdahl?
No.
Representative Wills?
No.
Representative Yaruso?
Yes.
Representative Faust? Representative Faust excused, and Representative Breinert. And Representative Breinert is excused.
Very well. Members, on a vote of 10 ayes and 9 nays, the motion does prevail.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Members, we will stand adjourned until our next meeting Wednesday at 6:45 until the call of the chair.